And from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, holding a Welcome Back food tasting for returning students, faculty, and residents on Saturday, August 28th. Featured will be more than 100 international food items, including cheeses, olives, breads, chocolates, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue, Champaign. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera. Season tickets are now available for the 2004-2005 season. This season's performances feature the Beaux-Arts Trio's Golden Anniversary, String Serenade with the Pacifica Quartet, American Classics with Rudolf Hocken, and David Harris' Much Ado About Mozart, and An Evening of Romance featuring pianist Ian Hobson. For information about season tickets, call 333-6280.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about identity thefts, and our guest will be Stephen Baker. He is Midwest Regional Director for the Federal Trade Commission. Identity theft is not new, but it seems to be something that is growing all the time. We'll talk about what it is, how it happens, what you can do to protect yourself. That'll be in the first hour. Hour number two, we will look at the question, why is it that people do things often that are against their best interest? And our guest there will be John Portman. He's Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at University of Virginia. And we'll be talking about a recent book that he has authored. It explores this question. It's titled Bad for Us, The Lure of Self-Harm. That's tomorrow in the second hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you each week, and we always give you the opportunity to call in with questions or comments. In this part of the show, we will explore some of the history of an invention that is relatively recent, but something that very quickly seemed to become indispensable. And now it's something that is in just about every office. It's in public places where you can put in coins and use it. And a lot of people actually have their own in their homes. And what we're talking about here is the plain paper office copier. It was first introduced in 1960. It's been called the most successful product ever marketed in America. But there were points at which it looked like that product might actually never come to the market, as a number of very big companies looked at the idea and said, nobody's ever going to want one of these things. Our guest for the program is David Owen. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's authored a dozen books, and he is the author of a recent one, which is entitled Copies in Seconds. It looks at Chester Carlson and the birth of the Xerox machine. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is out now in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Of course, questions are welcome here on the program as we move through the hour. The only thing we ask is people just be brief in their questions and comments so we can keep the program moving along. But anybody who's interested in calling can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And the toll-free line, that one is good no matter where you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. As a matter of fact, if you're listening on the internet, if you're outside of our immediate area here, you can use that number too, as long as you're in the United States, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Owen, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, good to be here.
It's quite an interesting story, I think, and certainly one of those stories that shows you that sometimes tenacity can pay off, even if it's against pretty long odds.
Yeah, it's remarkable tenacity, and it's sort of, inevitably think, well, gee, would I have stuck with this for as long as he did? And I don't think many people would have. It was an amazing example of persistence beginning in his childhood. Chester Carlson had one of the worst childhoods, I think, in the history of the United States, and somehow managed to not only educate himself, but then to make a huge contribution to the art of communication.
Yeah. Two major points we might make right here at the beginning, and then we can go into some detail and talk more about Chester Carlson. And the two things that you point out that are maybe noteworthy about xerography and the technique of copying things. One is that unlike a lot of other technologies that build on what came before, that this process that came to be called xerography, it's unlike anything that came before, any other technology that came before it.
Yes, Crossland was really alone in a way that 20th century high-tech inventors have almost never been. The process that he came up with, most people assume that xerography is related somehow to conventional photography, but it's not. It's completely different. And Carlson was the only one. There was no one competing with him. There was, you know, the Chinese didn't invent it 1,000 years ago. It was out of his own head, and kind of even in once the development process had been underway for more than a decade, even highly trained scientists were skeptical that it was even, you know, theoretically feasible. When the machines were actually being assembled, there were people who said, well, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's noteworthy is that while it is true that as we come from an idea and a process to a product that actually can do it, that people can buy, and certainly people contributed to that, again, unlike a lot of other modern inventions, the idea for xerography basically was this one guy's idea, this fellow Chester Carlson.
Yes. It's astonishing to go back and read his first patent application, which he filed in 1937, in which he, the first few over those first couple of years, in which he anticipates the future of copying. And not only that, but later, one thing that's sort of remarkable about it is that it's still the world's plain paper copying technology. It's also the technology in a laser printer. A laser printer is a xerographic copier in which the information comes not from, isn't reflected from a sheet of paper, but is digitally written by a computer-controlled laser beam. But it's the same process inside. And in fact, laser printers were invented by a Xerox researcher back in the early 70s.
Yeah.
It's the technology that makes it possible for me now. You know, you used to, there's no whiteout or correcting tape anymore in my office, and it's one of it's the horrible thing where you write a letter to somebody and you see a comma is missing, so you don't just stick the comma in with a pencil and a carrot. You reprint the whole page. It's a technology that's made that possible.
Yeah, so much for the paperless office.
That's
what
exactly.
We all thought, that somehow with the coming of the Internet and using word processing and all this kind of stuff, that we would be using less paper. But I think it's been amply demonstrated that we're using far more paper than ever before. And I'm sure that the fact that you can just click your mouse and make as many copies of something as you want, that's contributed to that.
Yeah, certainly anybody who goes to a committee meeting can see the dark side of the ability to make copies, which makes it all the more remarkable that when the first machine was introduced in the early 60s, people didn't anticipate really any of it. It was an invention like the VCR in that people didn't really know what it was for until they had it. I mean, you think back to the VCR, the motion picture industry fought it with millions of dollars of lobbying in Washington, and it ended up really kind of saving Hollywood because it turned out something that no one anticipated, which was that people would gladly pay money to watch movies at home that they would never pay money to watch in a theater. And it's people didn't realize that sort of what copying was in the sense that we understand it now.
Yeah. Well, that's also interesting because you can see as we're sort of jumping ahead in the story a little bit, but as Carlson went along and he tried to interest some large companies in the idea and then in the device, it seems surprising to me that that several large companies, and I'm sure that companies where they were doing it for internal distribution, they were duplicating and distributing documents. The idea that here would be a machine that would be easy to use, it would be very quick, and could turn out a lot of documents. They looked at it and they literally said, "Well, what do we need that for?"
Right, right. They thought, you know, and they did. There's one thing I talk about in the book is the history of the copying problem, which is as old as writing is. The solution for centuries was if you needed a second copy of a written document, for centuries the only solution was to write it out again. And then at various times over the history of civilization, people came up with solutions. Thomas Jefferson was a great student of the copying problem. Ben Franklin was too. Franklin invented a sort of crude copying machine. Jefferson owned a number of machine, one called a pantograph, machine that looks like connects two pens together, and you write with one of them, and the second pen makes a a perfect duplicate of the original document. Throughout history, there's been, James Watt, the inventor of the modern steam engine, invented a copying machine, the before the Xerox machine, the most successful office copier in history. It was called the copying press, and what it did was you would write a letter by hand with ink. When the ink was still somewhat wet, you would place another piece of paper on top of it, and you would squeeze them together, and the second sheet would become the copy. That was for almost a century and a half. That was the only way to make an exact copy of a document that already existed, and it was limited in that you had to think of doing it while the original was still wet.
Let me just real quick here tell people who are listening that our guest is David Owen. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has authored a dozen books. And a new one here that we're talking about is all about the birth of the Xerox machine. The title of the book is Copies in Seconds, published by Simon & Schuster. Questions 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about Chester Carlson. As you say, he had a very hard scrabble childhood. The family was poor. It moved a lot. His father had poor health. Chester, to help support the family, had to start working when he was only 8.
Yes, he started working when he was 8, and by the time he was in high school, he was his family's principal support. You wouldn't believe it if it were fiction. It was they lived in a hut in Mexico for a while. They lived in a uninsulated shed in the snow-covered mountains outside San Bernardino, California, one winter. His mother had to, each morning, she would flash a signal with a little mirror down to the valley to let people know that they'd survived another night. He didn't have friends. There was a school he attended where he was the only student, and he would peer in through the window at recess and see his teacher sort of sitting in deep depression, not surprisingly, sort of chin in hand on the desk, waiting for the day to be over, basically. For a time, he and his father, after his mother died of tuberculosis, he and his father was unable to work, lived in a chicken coop. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. And yet he managed to work his way through a sort of work-study program at a junior college and then to transfer to Caltech, where he got the training in physics that it eventually enabled him to make his invention.
Yeah. He apparently, from the time that he was young, was very interested in science and had this idea that he was going to be an inventor.
Yes, he decided early on that the only chance for someone like him, who came from poverty and from a limited educational background, that his only chance to make a fortune was to invent something. And he actually, even when he was his direction, even when he was young, sort of focused on the graphic arts. He had a fair bit of experience with printing. The toy he coveted most when he was 10 was a typewriter. He worked in a printing shop when he was a little bit older, and sort of marveled at how difficult it was to get text into print, thought. Even then, that, you know, wouldn't it be good if there were a simpler way to do this? And later on, after Caltech, he ended up in patent law. He was sort of all thumbs in the laboratory, and at Bell Labs transferred to the patent office and became a patent attorney. And there, he was struck by how difficult it was to obtain copies of patent documents. At that point, it always involved secretaries typing multiple carbons and often retyping to get enough copies, and drawings had to be sent out to be reproduced on a photostat machine, which was basically a big camera, a big photographic camera. You would take a photograph of a page, and that was invented in the early 1900s and was the only method of making that kind of copy. But it was expensive. It took a long time. You had to send it out. The machines were so big that nobody had them in their office, and it involved messy chemicals, and it was an unsatisfactory solution. He thought that there should be a machine that you could stick a piece of paper in, press a button, and a copy would come out the other side, and that's what he ended up inventing.
Yeah. Why, as you mentioned, he managed to get himself to junior college and he studied chemistry and physics, and then he went to Caltech, and after he graduated, he went to Bell Labs, and that was a really disappointing experience for him. Maybe they also were sort of disappointed in him. What was it that he just didn't click with that job?
He had trouble getting along. I think he was so shy, and so his most of his life was internal. He had very few friends when he was little because his parents were always moving him around. That he didn't have a lot of social skills. He was actually an old roommate of his in New York City when he was a young man said that he actually was girls found him very attractive because he was so shy and I don't know well behaved I guess but he was he wasn't a big loud personality and that also worked against him later when he was trying to sell his idea. He pitched it to IBM and Kodak and General Electric and RCA, and they couldn't see the future in it, but they also, I think, if he'd been more of a more flamboyant salesman, he might have gotten a little bit farther. He said later that if he'd simply built a machine with red and green lights on it that flashed and made noise, he would have had more success, even if it didn't work, because people would have paid more attention.
Yeah, well, that sort of was the problem once he got the idea and kind of developed it and established the fact that it could work, at least in the beginning. It didn't work beautifully, but it worked. Then he shopped the idea around and went to a number of big companies, and as you say, one of them was IBM. And they just weren't very impressed. Partly he was hampered by the fact that he wasn't a very good salesman, but the other thing was he didn't have a working model. He could explain to them the basic process, and I guess his hope was that they would look at that and say, oh, yeah, okay, we get it. We see that can work, and we can develop it. And they apparently weren't excited even by the very, as we discussed, weren't excited by the very idea of it. But
right.
Would it really have made that much difference if he could, as you say, if you said, okay, here it is, and I call it the whatever it is, and here it is, and let me show you how it works. He didn't even have something that would do that.
No, he could make these little business card size, fuzzy business card sized copies that didn't look like much. But it was a difficult process. It was the process. It's hard to explain in a single sentence. I think if you read the book, you'll understand basically how it works. But it involves photoconductivity and electrostatics, and it's highly vulnerable to atmospheric changes. That you can shuffle across in your socks across the carpet at some times of the year and get shocked, and at other times not. And the reasons why that's true also affect the ability of a xerographic machine to make copies. And so it took a long time for physicists and engineers to make a machine that would be even fairly reliable. And so there was no way that Carlson himself could have come up with a working model. There were too many processes that had to be figured out. And none of these big companies were able to make the kind of the mental leap to see that it was unreasonable to ask a lone inventor to come up with a working machine, because what it ended up taking a nonprofit research institute and a photographic supply company 15 years to really work out the problem.
Yeah. Well, let me see if I've got this right. As I also tried to understand, not being a scientist, how this works, and the way I think about it is basically what you're doing is you've got a metal plate, and on that plate, what you're doing is you're putting little electric charges that are the image of the document that you want to reproduce. And then you're dusting that with a kind of a powdered pigment, which sticks just to those places that are charged, which is the image of the document. And then what you're doing is you're using heat to permanently then transfer that pigment onto the piece of paper. And that's how you get your copy. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's basically it. And it's if you think of rubbing a balloon against your sweater, and then it'll pick up. You give an electrostatic charge to the surface of the balloon, which is the rubber is insulating. The charge can't drain away. It sits there right on top of the balloon. If you then touch the dust on a tabletop, the dust will stick to that charge. What Carlson combined that idea with the idea of photoconductivity, where there are certain materials that act as conductors when light is shining on them, and as insulators in the dark. It's what explaining the phenomenon is what Albert Einstein got his Nobel Prize for. And Carlson reasoned that if that metal plate were covered with a thin photoconductive material, you could place a charge on the whole surface and then shine the image of a page onto it, and the charge would bleed away from all the places where the light fell, which would correspond to the white parts of the page, and remain in all the dark parts, which would correspond to the ink. And then he could dust it with this powder and transfer it to a piece of paper and then heat it to make the pigment bond permanently with the paper. And that's the way the machines work. It's the way a laser printer works. And they now operate at such astonishing speed. You see one of these big, super-powered copiers that just spits out pages as fast as you can run paper through a machine, and it's still operating by exactly that technology. The color printers too, color lasers and color xerographic copiers. They just lay down layers of different colored pigments to. You split the image into the different colors, and then lay down the different layers of pigments, and then fuse it all together.
He, as you explained, and we kind of talked about, he got this idea. He developed a way, at least to demonstrate it imperfectly, but demonstrate that it could be done. Then he tried to shop the idea around, and nobody was particularly interested. And he was apparently very close to just giving up when he met an engineer who worked for something called the Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. This guy thought, well, that's pretty interesting, and at least some of the people at Battelle thought so too, thought it worth developing. How is it that he ended up getting involved with Battelle?
It was a sort of a lucky accident. He was working as a patent attorney, and he was involved in a case that Battelle was involved in too. He was then working for the company that was the predecessor of the Duracell battery division of Duracell batteries. It's the Mallory. It was a company called PR Mallory, which made electrical and electronic devices. And they were involved in a lawsuit, and he was talking with this guy from Battelle about it, and they had some time left at the end of the day. And Carlson said, as he often did, you know, I've got this patent in my desk. You know, would you take a look at it? And the engineer from Battelle was interested and had Carlson come out to Columbus, and it was the first time that he had made his demonstration to people who both understood what he was doing and saw that it was recognized that it was something unlike what anybody else was able to do. And this particular engineer said, this may not look like much, but it is the first time you have seen anyone ever make a copy on a plain piece of paper using a dry process. It's unique. And Battelle decided that they could fairly quickly and economically determine whether the idea had any future. That turned out to be not quite the case, but then Battelle did the early development work which was absolutely crucial.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to explain, are we talking with the kind of improvements in the development that they did, are we talking about stuff that's really very technical that might elude anybody but a scientist?
Well, I think it eluded scientists too initially. And in fact, a physicist who worked at Xerox and was involved in the early machines told me that, and he himself holds 155 xerography-related patents, he said, the more you understand about xerography, the more amazed you are that it works. So it's not merely a sign of scientific ignorance not to really completely understand what's going on. One of the biggest contributions that Battelle made was that Carlson made his little sample copies using a zinc plate coated with sulfur. Sulfur is a photoconductive material. The scientists at Battelle discovered that selenium, which is most of us know, if we know it at all, as an ingredient in dandruff shampoos, worked even better, 1,000 times better, had better properties than sulfur did, the use of selenium made it the idea much more viable for an office copier than it would have been otherwise. And in fact, it was one of the keys to the later success of Xerox. For a number of years, Xerox basically had a patent on the element selenium, and it enabled them to dominate that market for quite a while.
We are at the midpoint of this hour of focus, and again, I just want to introduce our guest, David Owen. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and has written a number of books, and one that's just out now looks at the history of the Xerox machine, how it was developed, and the man whose idea it was, Chester Carlson, Copies in Seconds, the title of the book, published by Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, as you said, Chester Carlson came up with this idea but could not develop it by himself and got a lot of help from the Battelle Memorial Institute. But also they had to have somebody who was interested in trying to develop the device that would actually implement the technique. And his idea came to the attention of a company in Rochester, New York. This was a company that made photographic paper. Apparently they felt that there was no way that they were going to be able to compete with their bigger neighbor, Kodak. And so they were looking for something else. Someone there at the company called Haloid thought that they're one of the few that looked at xerography and thought, well, okay, maybe we can do something with this.
They were the only. All these big companies had, you know, looked at it and said no. And the guys at Haloid decided that this might be their path out of the shadow of Kodak. It was, as you say, it was a small photographic supply company existing in the at the doorstep of the giant in the industry. The president of the CEO of the company was the son of the chairman and the grandson of the founder, and he was interested in establishing an independent identity for himself as well. So the company was primed to be interested in something new. It wasn't much of a company, and the people at Battelle and Carlson were not initially excited at all that this little company that they'd never heard of had an interest in their idea, and continued looking for other... they negotiated a very limited deal and then continued looking for other partners. They assumed that, they would make a limited deal with Haloid, and then somebody else would come along, and that would be the real thing. But that little company ended up becoming the Xerox Corporation 15 years later, and became one of the very largest corporations in the world. It grew at an astonishing rate. If you invested a $10,000 investment in the company in 1959, was worth $1 million by 1972, and there were a number of people in Rochester, including the University of Rochester, which became quite wealthy as a result of that change.
Yeah. One of the things that apparently the people involved in this were worried about early on was that Chester Carlson's patent would expire before Haloid could actually bring a machine to market. It sort of amazes me. Was it really the case that even at that point nobody else was working on this?
Nobody else was. The RCA later, as the machine got close, RCA came up with a process that was, they believed, didn't infringe any of Carlson's patents or Battelle's patents. There were a number of them by that point. They did the same thing by slightly. Starting from Carlson's idea, they found a way of making copies not on plain paper but on coated paper. They put the photoconductive surface on the paper instead of on the on a plate inside the machine or on a drum inside the machine. Carlson ultimately decided that it was a technological dead end, that it didn't solve the problem because it didn't make it possible to make copies on plain paper. And it turned out that he was right, but he always said that he thought it was the second best copying method. And then there were other companies, like 3M had a process called Thermofax, which also used a coated paper and used heat. There was one called Verifax. There was a sort of dye transfer and diffusion transfer, basically photographic processes that other companies were working with. In the 50s, there was sort of copying was kind of in the air. The sort of booming post-war American economy, and there was a need for copies of invoices and things like that. And there were a number of companies working on it. But all these processes depended on they were fatally flawed, Carlson felt, because the copies they made were terrible. They kept darkening long after they came out of the machine. They smelled bad. They rolled up into tubes. You couldn't file them. The paper felt cost a fortune and felt terrible. But all those machines existed. they didn't cost very much. A Thermofax machine cost as little as $100. You know, meanwhile, the people at what would become the Xerox Corporation were working on a machine that they had a sort of industrial strength machine that made copies on continuous paper, and it cost $130,000. So it wasn't they felt that they didn't look like a competitor to a lot of people.
Yeah, where did the word xerography come from?
There was a professor at in Ohio who Battelle, when they were getting ready to sort of make a public demonstration of the process, and they decided they needed a sexier name for it than the one that Carlson had come up with. He called it initially electron photography and then electrophotography. And the classics professor, who I just learned his name is, I think, is Robert Jones. I had never known the name, and I heard from a caller on a radio show in Columbus that that was what his name was. I hope I got it right. He's, all these years, he hasn't gotten any credit from anybody. He came up with the name based on Greek words for dry and writing. So a Xerox machine the process is dry writing. And when Haloid later decided that it needed a sexier name, it crafted Xerox from that, kind of on the model of Kodak. It's a similar word. It's kind of a bold. It has a lot of bold consonant sounds, and it begins and ends with a sort of hard consonant. They thought initially about Z-Rex. There were proponents of that within the company. Actually, within the company, most people didn't want to change the name, and it's interesting to read the correspondence back and forth between people at Haloid deciding that, you know, arguing that no, we can't give up this name. We've had it since 1906, and of course now the only word, the Xerox, seems like it seems like one of the. You figure it must be carved in stone someplace.
Yeah. Well, you know, even though that now we have all these devices that use that process, different people make them, but we still talk about, it's like Kleenex.
Right.
Anything that's copied is a Xerox. Or right. We even use that to describe the act of making the copy.
Yes, exactly. And it's the kind of thing that drives attorneys at big corporations crazy, because they figure it's going to weaken their trademark. The name is kind of indivisible from the process.
Well, was this company, Haloid, they were the ones that actually developed the device and eventually made what was the first commercially available plain paper office copier, the 914. And early on, at least, it had some problems and was prone now and again to bursting into flames.
Right, little simple things like bursting into flames,
like basically, which, you know, hey, not a problem. You know, and as we talked before, heat was involved in the process. And even now, if you go to your office printer, or when you're printing something off the printer, sometimes the documents come out. They're kind of warm to the touch, fresh out of the printer. So the heat still is in there. But I guess that was one of the things that they had a difficulty with right at the beginning, the heat that was involved in fixing the print image to the piece of paper.
Yeah, there were sort of cascading, interconnected problems. They wanted the machine to be the sort of thing that you could just plug right into the wall, so it had to use 120 volts and regular, you know, just an ordinary outlet. They only had so many amps and so many volts to spread around the different processes, which limited the amount of. They couldn't make the heater too big that fused the page. So it had to operate at a fairly low temperature, because they also wanted, you know, the machine to be compact. But at a low temperature, they then had all kinds of problems with the toner, with the development powder. If you've ever pulled a copy or a laser-printed page out of a paper jam and there's that little fine black dust on it that gets all over your hands, that's the toner. That has to melt into the paper, and yet can't melt at such a low temperature that it melts right away, and it can't melt at a high one, then it requires a really hot user, and then it has all kinds of, there are all kinds of other requirements that have to be met as well. And what they found as they began building the machines, that every time they tweaked one thing, they had to change a dozen other elements. These machines, it's astonishing to read the engineers and who built the first machines. They, you know, the first Xerox machines had, you know, there was a brush made of rabbit fur. The rabbit fur brushes were sewn by hand by a tailor who happened to have a shop on the ground floor of the building where the engineers worked. the prototypes were built with parts that these guys would scrounge in local junkyards, and you know they found they'd find a big long length of aluminum tubing and take it over to a local machine shop and have the guys tool it down to 8 inches or whatever the diameter that they needed. They looked for bolts and springs and in junkyards too. They had the optical group was working in the basement of a Masonic temple. More like a science fair project almost in some ways than what we think of as high-tech development. They had very limited funds. They had to sort of make up everything as they went along. And it's interesting. You talk to the guys who are still around who are involved in it. It was the most fun they ever had in their lives. They were working around the clock, days a week sometimes. It became the kind of consuming project of their lives. And they still look back on it when they talk about it. It was a great time. It was the most fun they ever had at work. And it must have been great. Early on, the physics group, the physicists were, they didn't have a big laboratory. They had it was just a regular house over on a kind of a crummy street in what's now inner city Rochester. And they had to be careful not to vent toner powder out the window on Tuesdays, because that was the day the lady next door hung her white linens out on the line. And they had no money, and they would go over and sneak into the Kodak cafeteria and eat lunch over there, and sometimes ask the Kodak scientists to help them with problems they were working on. There's one guy who was hired for his Xerox job while having lunch in the Kodak cafeteria. They interviewed him there. It was a very bare bones operation, but they loved it. It was the most fun they ever had.
Yeah, it sort of makes me think about the stories about Chester Carlson himself doing some of that initial research work in the kitchen of his apartment, much to the displeasure of his first wife.
Yes, yeah, she didn't like that. He tried. He was sort of all thumbs in the laboratory, and that didn't help. He tried at first to do his little experiments in the basement down in the coal storage area down in the basement of his apartment building, and ended up in the kitchen. And what he was trying to do was melt sulfur crystals on a little zinc plate, little zinc engraver's plate, and holding it with a pair of pliers. And the sulfur would inevitably catch on fire, and there was a terrible smell pervade the entire building, and the neighbors were unhappy, and his wife was unhappy, and his mean mother-in-law was unhappy, and he ended up hiring an out-of-work physicist who worked for him for 6 months and succeeded in making the first xerographic copy, which is in the Smithsonian Institution today. It's a little piece of wax paper, very small. But that, even he, this physicist who had succeeded in doing this thing that Carlson had dreamed of doing, he was so unimpressed by it that he left Carlson's. He stopped working for Carlson and went off and went to work for somebody else.
Yeah, he never thought it would amount to anything.
No, he had passed up the opportunity to become hugely rich in doing so.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with him in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Can you hear me well or not?
Yeah.
Okay. The actual xerographic process, I didn't think the heat had anything to do more than just fuse the toner to the paper.
That's correct.
Nothing to do with the actual electronic transfer.
No, the transfer is done electrostatically. A charge is applied to the back of the paper. It kind of lifts the toner from the photoconductive surface, the photoreceptor. And you're correct. The heat is only in the fusing.
It's just fusing it.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is David Owen. He's staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His book is Copies in Seconds, Chester Carlson and the Birth of the Xerox Machine, published by Simon & Schuster. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that Carlson had taken the idea to some big companies who weren't terribly interested, and one of the things that they said was, well, what do we need this for? Who's going to make that many copies? And at the time, we were talking about maybe 100 copies a day. They said, well, nobody's going to make that many copies.
I know. It's amazing to read that when they were discussing these things, Carlson believed that 100 copies a day was probably the threshold at which it would become economically feasible to have one of these machines. And so the question was, will anybody ever need to make 100 copies a day? Mm-hmm. Would any company ever need to make 100 copies a day? And as they went along, as they began to have prototypes, they began to see that maybe people would. When they built the early 914 prototypes, they sent out to some companies in Rochester to let people try them out and see how they went. And they had terrible problems. They were always jamming and stopping and, you know, occasionally catching on fire.
Bursting into flames, yeah.
Yeah, right. But they had all manner of problems. And yet, when they went to collect these machines to bring them back to the lab, nobody wanted to give them up. Hmm. And they found the same thing later with the first production machines that went out. People would have horrendous problems with them, but the response was not to angrily send it back. It was to sign up for, you know, to lease another machine, a second or a third, so there would always be a backup, at least a backup that was functioning. And Xerox actually did that. They had in their lease program, all these machines were leased. In their lease program, they had a deeply discounted deal for a second machine. So you get your first one for $100 a month, and then the second one for $25 a month. And it actually saved Xerox money because it meant that they didn't have to be as quick in getting the repair guys out sometimes on a daily basis to keep the machines running.
Well, given that there was so much skepticism initially on what sort of demand there would be for such a device and how heavily it would be used, was it difficult, particularly in the beginning, for Xerox to sell the 914?
Well, it's amazing. When it began, almost from the beginning, they couldn't keep up with the demand. Now, at that point, they were producing machines at just a glacial pace. It took them forever to get a machine out the factory door. So, we're not talking about millions of copiers by any means. But once a company had a machine, really from the first day, people suddenly thought of uses for it and used it constantly. It seemed almost miraculous to have a copy come out that was on a, it didn't smell bad, it didn't curl up, it didn't keep getting dark. It was easy. You did it by pushing a button. It was a problem that Xerox faced in those days was that it was easy to sell the machines if you could demonstrate them, but it was very hard to demonstrate them because it weighed 650 pounds. It was hard to show it to large groups of people. And they realized with some sorrow that they were going to have to advertise on television. They did a commercial that it featured a man who was sitting at his desk, and a little girl comes over and he says, "Would you make a copy of this for me, please?" She says, "Sure, Daddy." And he says, "That's my secretary." And she goes, this little girl skips off to the 914 and puts the paper on the glass plate and closes it and presses a button, and out comes a copy. And then she takes it back to her father, and then she decides, she makes a copy of her rag doll, too. And when she hands the paper back to her father, he says, "Thank you," and then says, "Which is the original?" And she says, "I forget." And it astonished people. There were complaints to the government that this couldn't possibly, a child couldn't possibly do this, that it had to be, that it was all faked, that the government investigated, the FCC or whoever it was, and determined that, no, in fact, it really did work. And what they did is actually the government agent who came to investigate, they persuaded him by explaining to him how the machine worked and then letting him go alone into the other room, and make a copy by himself, and he realized that it really did do what they said it did.
I also like the story about the ad campaign that said it's so easy, even a chimp can a copy at much, and caused much low humor apparently in a lot of offices around the country.
Yeah, they remade the little girl commercial with using a chimpanzee, and the chimpanzee really did make a copy. But then the next day, the secretaries came to work and found bananas on their desks and people making rude remarks, and Xerox at that point depended so much on the goodwill of office workers, the office workers who ran the machines, usually a secretary who was known as the key operator, when you see that little sign flashing on an on a copier that says call key operator, it means call the person in the office who has been specially trained to, you know, put out fires and undo paper jams. Mm. And Xerox depended so much on the goodwill of these people that the marketing guys said, you have to, the commercial has to be pulled immediately. We're going to lose the people we need to keep the machines working. And they did. It aired only once or maybe twice, and that was it.
Well, we have another caller here. Let's talk with them. Again, Champagne, line one, right here. Hello.
Hi, good morning. It seems that without Carlson's determination and a little bit of luck, that the technology wouldn't have come to fruition or might have only come about much later. And I was wondering whether in your through your researches, if you've come to any conclusions or learned any lessons about how we can better nurture new technology that might be promising.
You know, I've wondered that, and I don't know. It was the kind of thing where if he had not been so determined in persisting, it might not have been no one might have come up with it until some adequate substitute was already in place and so universally used that there would have been no market for it then. I don't know. You know, one of the keys to people said is that one of the keys to the success of what became the Xerox Corporation was that nobody at the company at the time they sort of bought into Carlson's idea, nobody at the company was a physicist. There was nobody there who knew enough to be skeptical about it. And if they'd had a real scientific staff, they might never have gotten involved. Physicists typically would look at it and say,
oh, this can't work.
There's no way that this could work in a machine.
Yeah.
And, IBM, there were several times, several points at which IBM was very interested in either licensing the machine or buying the rights outright and doing it itself. But they did the final key moment was IBM hired a major consulting company to do a study. What's the market for this machine? This was in the late 50s, and it was Arthur D. Little, major consulting firm, and they did a big study and decided in the end that there was a total market of maybe a couple of thousand machines, and that was it, and that there was no future to the idea, and IBM backed out. And that was a deeply depressing moment for what would become the Xerox Corporation, but they decided to go ahead anyway. There were repeated moments when the people at Haloid and later at Xerox just, you know, they decided to go ahead anyway, and it was partly faith and partly just, I don't know, a similar kind of determination. They were determined in the way that Carlson was. So
yes.
It's hard to extract a lesson from it. There was the best I think I heard was something a researcher at Battelle said, which is he said when you have a truly original idea, you don't take a vote. And I think that was key, that there were people who sort of gave each other courage and just were determined to see it through to the end. And if at any point they had, you know, put it up to a vote or listened to the consultants,
they wouldn't have.
I think another thing is that, you know, you often hear about companies that are customer driven. This was the opposite of being customer driven. Customers didn't know what it was for. They didn't know what they wanted or if you had relied solely on the opinion of customers, which is pretty much what the consultants did.
Right, right.
You never would have gone ahead.
There's nothing there, right?
So sometimes you have to just plunge in. It's interesting that the VCR had a somewhat similar kind of development period when it just seemed like such an improbable technology and no one knew what it was for. And I remember reading that the early videotape, it took miles of tape to make even a few seconds of image, and the image was of very poor quality. And the scientists who were developing it initially were able to create a huge increase in the resolution of the image by just taking out the front row of seats in the auditorium where they were demonstrating it so that no one could sit close enough to it to see how poor it was.
That's interesting. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time, and there is one little bit I just want to make sure that I have you talk about here, and that is something of the rest of the life of Chester Carlson. The company, obviously Xerox, was, I suppose in a sense it was the Microsoft of its time. It became a huge company, became very profitable, and people associated with it made a lot of money. He, however, did not live like a wealthy man. He lived a very modest life, even though he reaped great financial rewards. And he gave away a lot of the money that he had made, and he did it anonymously.
Yeah, it's just amazing. He and his wife lived in a nice house, but it was it had three bedrooms. They added a fourth bedroom at one point, but they never owned a second car. They didn't own a television set until very late in his life. They never owned a second home. When Carlson traveled abroad, as he occasionally did, his wife had to tell him not to buy third-class train tickets. They lived very modestly, and his wife said after he died, and captured it well, she said that his true wealth consisted of all the things that he could easily live without. And the philanthropy was interesting and complex. He when he first became a success, it's what he dreamed of his whole life. And now he was middle aged. He was successful beyond anybody's dreams. And yet he didn't really know what to do next. And finally, and somewhat reluctantly, he decided that the next sort of purpose of his life would be to give this fortune away. And he said several times that his ambition was to die a poor man. And he gave away a huge fortune, entirely anonymously. It was always a condition that no one would know where it had come from. His name was not engraved on buildings until occasionally after he had died. But when he gave a large building to Caltech, for example, and the building was named not for him, but for the professor who had he felt had helped him the most. He would do things like he would buy apartment buildings in New York City and Washington, D.C. so that they could be integrated. This was in the early 60s. He gave huge amounts of money to organizations involved in race relations and world peace and similar kinds of things, and he would pay off the mortgages of impoverished little old ladies, always anonymously, and he always made all the decisions himself, and so that became his second career in a way. And then he died much too young. He was just in his early 60s. He died in 1968, but very peacefully. He lived a life that is, I don't think a modern. I don't think almost anyone would read the story of his life and say, "I wish that this were my life." And yet he lived a life of great hardship and died very much at peace with himself and with his in a way that truly is enviable.
Well, there we'll have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. The book is Copies in Seconds by our guest David Owen, Simon & Schuster, the publisher. David Owen is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you very much for talking with us. Programs made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, healthy heart, plus size, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start after Labor Day. Information at 344-YOGA.